the most comprehensive record of what has happened in the Bradley Manning trial so far is being kept fastidiously by Alexa O'Brien, who is completely in the Bradley Manning camp.
The rest of the media is relying on her, so be glad she takes good notes. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Among the charges facing famous leaker Bradley Manning is aiding the enemy, a capital offense. If the charge sticks, what would it mean?
That every time you leak a national security document to any medium that can be accessed over the net from everywhere, you are indirectly communicating with the enemy.
And 10 years after Shock and Awe, we reconnect with Iraqis who took foreign journalists where they could never go on their own.
You can see everything is being taken from you and like you're an alien in your country. I thought, okay, I couldn't do anything as a doctor. Probably I could do something as a journalist.
That and more coming up.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is a free service of WNYC Radio. Go to onthemedia.org to find out where On the Media is playing in your area and to support your local public radio station. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.
On the Media is supported by Squarespace, dedicated to providing a simple way to create a website, blog, or online store. Squarespace provides templates and tools to create a professional website. For a free trial, visit squarespace.com/media.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. Bob Garfield is away. I'm Brooke Gladstone. This week, a leak surfaced regarding the nation's most famous leaker, at least since Daniel Ellsberg. Army Specialist Bradley Manning, arrested in 2010 for passing classified material, lots of it, to WikiLeaks. On February 28th, he confessed to a military judge to leaking videos of airstrikes and diplomatic cables, and he read a 35-page statement. The audio of that statement leaked this week, and the sound is pretty bad.
I am the type of person who wants to know how things work, and as an analyst, this means I always want to figure out the truth. Unlike other analysts in my section or other sections within 2nd Brigade Combat Team, I was not satisfied with just scratching the surface and producing canned or cookie-cutter assessments. I wanted to know why something was the way it was and what we could do to correct or mitigate a situation.
This is the first time most of us have actually heard Manning, though we've heard plenty about him. The story of a troubled 22-year-old gay man in a don't ask, don't tell world who wrote instant messages to a convicted hacker full of bravado and angst and moral outrage at the conduct of the military. And then that hacker, Adrian Lamo, turned him in. We can't assess Manning's motivations here, but we do know, because he told the court, why he leaked what he leaked.
I thought these cables were a prime example of the need for a more open diplomacy.
Manning pled guilty to 10 of the 22 charges against him. He did not plead guilty to aiding the enemy. Prosecutors made their case for that charge by likening Manning to Private Henry Vanderwater, convicted in 1863 of giving a Confederate newspaper a coded command roster. Vanderwater was convicted and sentenced to 3 months hard labor and a dishonorable discharge. Today, aiding the enemy is a capital offense, though the government says it won't seek execution. And University of Chicago law professor Jeff Stone says Manning's case bears utterly no resemblance to Vanderwater's.
First, that in 1863, the First Amendment had virtually no content. There'd been no judicial decisions about the meaning of the First Amendment, and I'm quite sure that it was not even considered. And second, it's clear that Vanderwater, the individual in that case, was in fact intending to aid the enemy. And the truth is, no one, so far as I know, claims that Bradley Manning's purpose was to aid the enemy.
Tell me about some of the decisions that have changed how we see the First Amendment in the 150 or so years since Vanderwater.
In the years since then, we've moved completely in our understanding of the right to free speech. The most dramatic and apt illustration of this was the Pentagon Papers case, in which the New York Times and the Washington Post published classified information leaked to them by Daniel Ellsberg, and the Supreme Court held that they could not be restricted from publishing the information unless the government could prove at the very least that the disclosures created a clear and present danger of grave harm to the nation. And the court said that nothing in the facts of the Pentagon Papers came close to that. and therefore that they could not be restrained. And that's the governing precedent today. If the government attempted to prosecute WikiLeaks or attempted to prosecute the New York Times for publishing the information that Bradley Manning leaked, that's completely different from what the law would have been in 1918 or, for that matter, in 1863.
Ultimately, Henry van der Water got a three-month sentence back in 1863, along with his dishonorable discharge. The prosecutors are presenting what is now a capital charge.
That's exactly right. It was not regarded as a major offense, and he was given a very, very modest sentence, particularly for a sentence during the Civil War. Of course, it's also the case that the government's view is that the harm allegedly done by Bradley Manning may have been much greater than the harm actually done by van der Water. But be that as it may, there's just no legal basis under the statutes as they currently exist, or I believe even with respect to the First Amendment, for charging or prosecuting Manning under this offense.
What about the issue of harm? So far, there hasn't been any strong case made that serious harm was done.
The general view is that a government employee or member of the military can be punished for the unauthorized disclosure of classified information as long as there is a reasonable possibility of harm to the government,
uh-huh.
A much different standard than the one that applies to publication of the information. I don't think it would be hard for the government to prove that some of the information leaked by Bradley Manning would satisfy that standard.
Do you think that Americans and the American media should be watching this case more closely than it has so far?
Absolutely. I mean, the greater deterrent the government can impose upon people who would be tempted to give information to the media, the more difficult it will be for the media to disclose it. And the problem here is that a lot of information looks in two directions. Think of the Pentagon Papers case, where one type of information revealed was that the United States had made secret deals with some of the countries around Vietnam to allow us to have bases there. And it was important that this be kept secret because if we can't keep those secrets, then other nations in the future may be reluctant to make similar arrangements with us. So the disclosure of that information is potentially harmful. But on the other hand, it's valuable information to understand that we're making these underground deals, that what we're giving up in return for this is something that might be important. And so the public does have a legitimate interest in knowing this. So in those cases, and this is what basically, as far as I can tell, the Bradley Manning information is, it may be harmful to disclose the information, but it's also valuable to disclose the information. And that's what makes this a tricky and interesting problem.
Jeff, thank you very much.
My pleasure as always.
University of Chicago law professor Jeff Stone. Media attention to Manning spiked when his lawyer described his prolonged detention in solitary confinement without his clothes or his glasses or even sheets. Then the attention waned again. Arun Roth, who reports for PBS Frontline and PRI's The World, says that mostly the press aren't following the pretrial minutiae in Fort Meade, and when they are, they're put in a room outside the court.
It's sort of like an auditorium in a community college. It's not very big. There's a projection screen in the front where we watch the proceedings on closed circuit and hear it over speakers. The difficult thing about it is that we don't get much support from the government in terms of supplying court documents, transcripts, even the docket about what's going to be coming up next in court. You know, there was a discussion early on among some of the networks about basically hiring a court reporter to sit there in the media center and transcribe everything that was going on. But nothing really came of that. I'm not sure why.
So is there important stuff that we're missing because there isn't a big media presence there?
Well, you know, there would be stuff that we'd be missing if it weren't for this group of hardcore independent journalists who are there all the time. There are three in particular, Alexa O'Brien, Kevin Gostola, and Adam Classfield, every single day. If not all three of them, at least one of them is there reporting on this. And there was an amazing moment, I think, for the media and the coverage of the story when back in November, there was a huge development in the story, and there was only one person there to cover, and that was Kevin Gostola for the blog Fire Dog Lake. I talked to him about it. Here he is.
Manning's defense lawyer, David Coombs, stood up in the courtroom and announced that Manning would be accepting responsibility for providing some of the charged information to WikiLeaks. And this was an incredible development in the court martial.
So then he writes up his story, and then all of a sudden, Kevin Gostola, who a year ago was covering it as an intern for The Nation, all of the major news organizations and my own are linking to his story. And if he hadn't been there, we wouldn't have heard about it.
Alexa O'Brien, part of Occupy Wall Street, Gostola, works for Fire Dog Lake. They're clearly of the Bradley Manning is an unambiguous hero school.
Yep.
Should those of us who are relying on their presence to bring us news of the trial be a little skeptical?
Well, like you said, they don't pretend to be objective at all. These are people that do believe Bradley Manning is a hero and come from that perspective. But here's Alexa's response to that.
I've thought about it quite a bit because this question oftentimes comes up, you know, with the sort of pejorativeness of being an independent journalist. And my response is there's nothing more objective than a transcript.
She's supplying transcripts that the government doesn't supply.
Yeah, because she is there every day.
I've used that transcript.
We all have. The most comprehensive record of what has happened in the Bradley Manning trial so far is being kept fastidiously by Alexa O'Brien, who is completely in the Bradley Manning camp. The only full record we had of that statement he made last month before it was leaked was on her website. The Guardian and others were all linking to it. We're all relying on her at this point. And I have to say that, you know, from what I've seen of Alexa's work as well as Kevin, you know, in terms of their straight reporting, they get it right.
Since most of us don't get to see Bradley Manning, what did he look like? What did he sound like over the course of his confinement?
Well, the image that we have had of Bradley Manning has changed quite a bit. Because we're really for the first time hearing him speak for himself. For so long, his story has been told by other people. We've had a few chat logs and, you know, friends and family and other people talking about him. When he spoke for the first time last year, he was very articulate. He was actually the most sympathetic witness that has been on the stand. Where before we might have had this image of him as being, you know, a confused kid, didn't really know what he was doing. He was a gay soldier living in a don't ask, don't tell, and that was pretty horrible for him in court. And especially in the statement that he gave a couple of weeks ago, people have been talking about him being the new Daniel Ellsberg. And it seems like he's really assumed that mantle. He gave a very articulate, almost a manifesto of sorts about why he leaked, why he was justified, and why it was the right thing to do.
Some suggest that this mantle may have been assumed after the fact. But if you read the exchanges with Adrian Lamo, the hacker acquaintance who ultimately turned him into the FBI, you see someone who was seriously motivated by what he saw as improper conduct by the government.
You know, there's a lot of shallow stuff and a lot of silly stuff in the chat logs, as there are in everybody's chat logs. But very clearly, he is wrestling with the morality of this. And a lot of the stuff that he expresses in a more articulate way in that statement he made before the court a couple of weeks ago, the seeds of that are in there. They're in the chat logs. It may be more articulate now. It may be more coherent. Maybe, you know, in a way, more edited for the public. But I don't think it's inauthentic.
Arun, thank you very much.
You bet, Brooke. Thank you.
Arun Roth reports for PBS Frontline and PRI's The World. Coming up, what if Manning had taken his trove to the Times and not WikiLeaks? Would he be facing the same harsh charge? This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. This is NPR. On the Media is supported by Squarespace, dedicated to providing a simple way to create professional websites for those who are growing a business, starting a blog, or opening an online store. Squarespace provides templates and tools to create professional websites. Users create sites that are mobile-ready, which include 24/7 support, a domain name, and e-commerce, all on the same platform. For a free trial, visit squarespace.com/media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Before Bradley Manning leaked documents to WikiLeaks, he says he tried to leak those documents to the Washington Post and the New York Times. A Washington Post reporter put him off by saying that she'd have to get a senior editor involved. The New York Times never called Manning back. In this week's New York Times, Columnist and former executive editor Bill Keller imagines what would have happened if the Times had returned that call.
First of all, we would have done the stories. I doubt that we would have initiated a great sharing program with The Guardian and Der Spiegel, partly for competitive reasons and partly because I think the lawyers would have been concerned that that would worsen our legal jeopardy and Bradley Manning's legal jeopardy. But we would have done pretty much what we did with the material that we got through WikiLeaks, which was give it to a bunch of reporters and said, find the stuff in here that's really interesting and be careful to leave out the stuff that might get somebody killed, and we will publish stories. The other thing that I think would not have been different is probably Bradley Manning's legal liability. The military was going to come after him. The New York Times, and I would argue WikiLeaks too, have the protection of the First Amendment, but he took an oath to protect the government's secrets that were entrusted to him. And so legally, he would have been just as liable if he'd come to the New York Times.
Daniel Ellsberg was more or less informed of that by Max Frankel when he brought the Times the Pentagon Papers, that he was going to be on his own.
I'm not sure what the conversations were between Max and Dan Ellsberg at the time, but it was certainly clear in the minds of people at the Times that, you know, the relationship between a source and a news organization only goes so far, because sources come to you with agendas. They want to put their own spin on the material, and you have to keep enough distance so that you're applying impartial judgment to the information that the source brings. We quite often agree to protect the identity of sources who come to us, and we honor that to the extent of some reporters having gone to jail. But when it comes to the law, the source and the recipient are in different places. The recipient has the protection of the First Amendment, and the source generally does not.
The Guardian has said it's felt a certain responsibility towards Bradley Manning. They have been very, very active in writing about his treatment and his confinement. The Times, not so much?
Not so much, but not at all. The Times editorialized very strongly against Bradley Manning's treatment when he was kept for an inexcusable amount of time in solitary confinement, some of it without his clothes.
The Times came a little bit late to that party.
Yeah, I think so. You know, we had no relationship with Bradley Manning. As far as I know, nobody at the Times has ever met him. And at the point when we got these documents from WikiLeaks, we were dealing with WikiLeaks and with these other news organizations. Bradley Manning was already in custody. So he's a bit of a distant figure and a bit of a mysterious figure. And yes, the Times was a little late to that issue. And I think, you know, as our public editor pointed out recently, a little slow in covering his trial.
If the Times had worked with Manning, and if Manning had the Times imprimatur, do you think he might not be facing the aiding the enemy charge he's facing now?
Well, this is completely speculation on my part, but I wonder. You know, while I regard WikiLeaks as entitled to exactly the same First Amendment protections that the New York Times is entitled to, the fact that he chose to deliver his material to an organization that clearly has an attitude about America, that talks about wanting to embarrass the imperialist power, in the subconscious or maybe even in the conscious of a prosecutor in the military justice system, it may very well have had some bearing on their decision to bring the overkill charge of aiding the enemy against him. And I would not be shocked if it had some bearing on the sentencing.
Do you think we know more about government misdeeds because Manning worked with WikiLeaks and not exclusively with the New York Times?
I think we know a lot more, I don't know about government misdeeds, but about how the government operates in different countries. And that's partly because WikiLeaks shared the information with a number of other news organizations. And stories that interest El País or Le Monde may not be the same stories that interest the New York Times. And since that initial splash of stories, WikiLeaks has been methodically taking information around to local newspapers. And they've been writing stories in Lebanon, in India, in Brazil, that are of very much of local interest, but would never probably attract the attention of The Guardian or The New York Times. So there's a lot more of the Bradley Manning leak that has gotten public attention as a result of the fact that it went to WikiLeaks.
So it was worth it.
What was worth what?
The trade-offs of sharing this material widely so that areas directly affected by the information in those cables were able to see them?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Look, you know, I've had disagreements with WikiLeaks along the way, and some of them have been vociferous on both parts. But complicated as it was sometimes dealing with WikiLeaks, I think it would have been more complicated to have to deal, you know, with this walk-in source who was offering us this huge database and deciding exactly how to proceed, what our relationship with this young soldier should be. We were spared because WikiLeaks did that piece of work. I think it actually was a good thing that we got this through WikiLeaks.
Bill, thank you very much.
Anytime.
Bill Keller is an op-ed columnist for the New York Times. At the top of the show, we heard law professor Jeff Stone suggest that there was very little chance that the aiding the enemy charge against Manning would prevail. But if it did, Harvard law professor Yochai Benkler says it would set a very dangerous precedent.
The judge asked the prosecutor point blank, would you have prosecuted in the same way had Manning leaked to the New York Times? And the answer was a very crisp, yes, ma'am. So there's no question that the prosecution's theory applies every bit as much to a leak to traditional media as it does to WikiLeaks. That's what's so dangerous about it.
Elucidate what that danger is.
Here's the basic theory the prosecution has of the case. There are classified documents, classified because revealing them to the public might cause risk to personnel, to operations. Therefore, whoever releases them is aiding the enemy. So this means that every time you leak a national security document to any medium that can be accessed over the net from everywhere, you are indirectly communicating with the enemy.
Why would the government pursue that charge while the administration is already on the record as saying they won't actually seek the death penalty?
I think the effect of finding Bradley Manning guilty of aiding the enemy would be to simply terrorize future whistleblowers. Imagine you're a whistleblower. You go to a lawyer and you say, here's what I'm thinking of doing. The lawyer has to think defensively for you. The lawyer has to look at this precedent and say, is this something that could be read by the enemy and help them if it's published online? And if the answer to that is yes, then a reasonable, competent lawyer will have to say, I don't know how likely it is, but you really are risking this capital offense. We depend on whistleblowers in order to expose corruption, in order to expose malfeasance, in order to expose stupidity. Do we really want them to have to worry about whether they will face a capital offense? I think that's much too high a price to ask them to pay for our benefit.
Now, you might have been called to testify that Manning would have been reasonable in equating WikiLeaks with the New York Times as similar journalistic enterprises. Now that argument appears to be moot. You think it won't come up in the trial now?
The judge still will permit the testimony, and therefore I likely will testify and will have to go over that particular question.
How would you argue that WikiLeaks and the New York Times are similar organizations and therefore deserving of the same freedom of the press from the court?
I think it's very hard from the perspective of early 2013 to capture the way the world saw WikiLeaks in early 2010. You have to read every single newspaper story that talked about WikiLeaks from the moment it was founded. And the image that you see is very clearly of an active, aggressive journalistic organization exposing corruption and violence in Africa, showing how a Swiss bank uses Cayman Islands accounts to let rich clients not pay taxes, showing how pharmaceutical companies have influence within the World Health Organization in policy setting. More probably in the family of ProPublica or the Bureau of Investigative Journalism in the UK than just a blog or even something like Huffington Post or the Daily Beast.
I have to take exception here a little bit, Yochai, because although WikiLeaks has exposed much malfeasance, Julian Assange himself said to us that they applied no editorial judgment.
WikiLeaks is not a normal news organization. We are a public service to whistleblowers who are trying to get their messages out. Our judgment would be a form of censorship of those whistleblowers.
There was a lot of anything goes very early on, just around late 2006, early 2007. Then as the organization began to actually function, you saw an emphasis on verification of authenticity, selectivity in what came up.
So it evolved from its original philosophy.
Very quickly.
In your New Republic piece, you invoke the old legal adage that hard cases make bad law. What do you mean by that?
This is a hard case because WikiLeaks is very different in its editorial structure and organization than the New York Times. And that mixture of disclosures about the United States and the portrayal of Assange at a personal level lead to a media narrative that emphasizes the irresponsibility and danger of WikiLeaks. So it's relatively easy to say, well, this is an unusual case. It's a soldier, not a civilian. It's hundreds of thousands of documents, not 15. All of these things will lead a judge to say, in this case, we will hold that aiding the enemy applies. The problem is that once you make the decision, the precedent is set. And once the precedent is set, it takes on a life of its own.
Yochai, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yochai Benkler is a Harvard Law professor and also faculty co-director of the Berkman Center for Internet and Society. Right now, WikiLeaks remains under near financial blockade, and as of June 2012, its founder, Julian Assange, has been holed up inside the Ecuadorian embassy in London, where he's been granted diplomatic asylum. The British government says it intends to extradite him to Sweden, where he's wanted in questioning in a sexual assault investigation. Assange claims that the U.S. is waiting to extradite him from Sweden to face charges related to the Manning leaks. Cyrus Farivar, senior business editor at Ars Technica, recently observed that despite its current ill fortunes, WikiLeaks has inspired a rash of copycats. Quebec Leaks, Brussels Leaks, Enviro Leaks, RU Leaks, and UniLeaks for universities, to name a few. But in spite of this flood of aspiring leak sites, the leaks themselves seem to have dried up.
It's great if you have 50,000 sites that can publish leaks, but at the end of the day, you need leakers. If there's one thing that the case of Bradley Manning shows, it's that you can get in an awful lot of trouble if you leak really important stuff. So it takes a certain type of person with a certain type of conviction, not to mention a certain type of access, willing to face the music, as it were. So far, the only two major sites beyond WikiLeaks are an outfit out of Bulgaria that's called Balkan Leaks, and another one that's called Local Leaks, which has ties to Anonymous and has been publishing documents pertaining to the Steubenville, Ohio alleged rape case. There's also a new platform out of Italy that's called Global Leaks that is also still in progress.
So begin with Balkan Leaks.
They are run by two guys. One lives in Bulgaria, the other lives in France. They're both journalists and they're both information activists. They're using a software that's called Tor, the de facto gold standard in terms of keeping information and people and data anonymous and encrypted online. And so they've written up instructions in Bulgarian, in Macedonian, in other regional languages, explaining to people precisely how to use this tool and why it's important that they use it. One of the things that they've gotten most recently is a really interesting government dossier concerning the recently departed Prime Minister of Bulgaria, Boris Borisov.
Recently departed, why?
BalkanLeaks published what's called the Buddha dossier, which outlined to the public in more detail than had ever been seen before the fact that the previous government had recruited him as a government agent for his believed ties to the Bulgarian underworld. Within weeks, Mr. Borisov stepped down from the head of the Bulgarian government. I asked BalkanLeaks's head if they thought that the fact that the prime minister had stepped down was a direct result of their publication. And, you know, they seemed to be okay with taking a little bit of credit, but they were reticent to accept all of the credit.
So now tell me about this Italian project called Global Leaks, which evidently is trying to construct the next generation of leak sites.
What Global Leaks wants to do is they want to create a framework, a platform, an application, if you will, that anybody could use and install and verify on their own. So there could be a Global Leaks partner or client in Brazil and another one in South Africa and another one in California and another one in Japan. Conceivably, anybody could run a properly secured leaking platform.
They're franchising.
In a way, yeah.
So now tell me about the third successful site based in the United States. It's called Local Leaks. It has garnered a lot of attention for its coverage of the alleged rape of a high school girl in Steubenville, Ohio. And that trial has just begun this week. You say that Local Leaks stands out among these sites. How?
Unlike WikiLeaks, unlike Global Leaks, unlike Balkan Leaks for that matter, Local Leaks is inviting people to submit documents and photos and is collecting its own kinds of digital material and is compiling them into a long, detailed, and frankly, quite plausible chronology and narrative, trying to tell what it calls the hard truth of the Steubenville alleged rape situation.
It takes in material from the community, analyzes it, creates a narrative using a wide variety of sources, tweets, Facebook, Instagram, and so on. Let's see, is there a word for doing that? Let me think. No, I can't think of one.
I think that that's a fair point. Something that's often frustrating about some of these larger leak sites is that all too often they just act as repositories for huge volumes of information. It's really difficult for people to know what's important and what's not. And as you say, when journalists or other people take the time to sift through that, I think that that provides a valuable service.
What about the websites inspired by WikiLeaks that aren't grassroots, that have been launched by The Wall Street Journal and Al Jazeera? Have they gone anywhere?
Not as far as I'm aware. The Wall Street Journal site in particular came under heavy scrutiny because there was some language in its terms and conditions that basically said that if you're a leaker, potentially The Wall Street Journal, if forced to, could turn over your identity. WikiLeaks, Global Leaks, and Balkan Leaks, as much as they're able, shield the identity of the leaker so that they really don't know where the leak came from. It's important to remember that in the case of Bradley Manning with WikiLeaks, the reason why we even know Bradley Manning's name is because a journalist that he confessed to turned him into the feds.
Cyrus, thank you very much.
You're welcome, Brooke.
Cyrus Farivar is the senior business editor at Ars Technica. Coming up, 10 years after Shock and Awe, we return to the Iraqi fixers who made the coverage possible. This is On the Media.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. Next Tuesday marks the 10th anniversary of the Night of Shock and Awe, exploding across the night sky over Baghdad, the opening salvo in a nearly 9-year war. It was a deadly conflict to cover, especially if reporters were not embedded with U.S. troops. Foreign reporters increasingly relied on Iraqis to take the risks on the ground. Back in 2006, I reported on 3 Iraqis pulled into journalism by a trick of fate, caught up in the wave of correspondence pouring in from the West. We'll replay that and then see where they are now. My story begins with writer George Packer, author of The Assassin's Gate, who founded the blog called Healing Iraq while covering Iraq for The New Yorker.
Well, the first time you go to his blog, it says something like, views of an Iraqi dentist. And then there's a quote, I believe, from Swift So you're just thinking an Iraqi dentist whose epigraph on his blog is from Jonathan Swift, and who is writing these long, informed, historical accounts of what's going on in Iraq today. Who is this guy? Where did he learn all this? You know, why is he writing this? Is he real?
It is useless to attempt to reason a man out of what he was never reasoned into. That's the epigraph from Swift that sits atop Healing Iraq.
I thought he was maybe 50, not a guy in his mid to late 20s, because he seemed so reflective and sort of sad and slightly disdainful about the militias and about the violence and about Iraqi politicians and about American mistakes. But there was no hysteria and there was no rank partisanship. He somehow seemed to take the whole thing in and see it as the tragedy that it was and is.
I thought that in the early days of the war, the Western media was just pouring into Iraq and they were confused about everything and they were just missing a local perspective.
Ziad, he prefers to leave off his last name, writes Healing Iraq.
There were many misconceptions in the Western press, too many to count, so I just tried to do one at a time, and that I thought that would be my mission. I was probably one of the few people who actually supported the war, at least in my community in Baghdad. I wanted to convey that sense and that support.
Ziad is now studying journalism at the City University of New York, reporting on local stories in Brooklyn. On Monday, he posted this on Healing Iraq.
Another close friend of mine has been killed in Baghdad. We had lunch together in Baghdad just days before I left. I can't concentrate on anything anymore. I should not be here in New York, running around a stupid neighborhood asking people about their issues. I now officially regret supporting this war back in 2003. The guilt is too much for me to handle.
Do you feel like you've marooned yourself onto a desert island or something?
Yes, sometimes I have that feeling. I get depressed many times and think, what am I doing here? I mean, I should be back with my family. I mean, if they're in danger, at least I should be in danger with them. I can't be safe here while they're suffering over there. I'm also willing to learn. That's what I came here for. That's at least what I tell myself.
Ziad doesn't see himself as a newspaper or TV reporter. He doesn't want to work for a Western news agency. He's not even ready to renounce dentistry. But for now, he says he needs to reach out to the West his way.
Maybe my focus on online journalism is kind of my way out of this. not to be immersed too much in the risks and at the same time doing my best to get out the story. I mean, that's what I can do. I mean, I can't be like any of those brave Iraqi stringers who went to Fallujah and embedded with insurgents. And I could never do that.
Ali Fadil does that, a doctor who ran afoul of Saddam's regime when he bought a color laser printer without permission. He fled and was practicing medicine in Yemen. When Baghdad fell, he returned.
To participate in building my country. And I thought, we have now a new Iraq. We'll have the best Iraq ever in the world. I have to be there from the beginning.
But in the Baghdad hospital where he worked, the equipment didn't work. The security was non-existent.
And worse than that, politics was coming into the hospitals. It was coming into the Minister of Health. You can see everything is being taken from you and like you're an alien in your country. At that time, I was approached by the media, by the Financial Times. I thought, okay, I couldn't do anything as a doctor. Probably I can do something as a journalist.
Did it ever occur to you before this point that this might be a profession you'd want to be in, journalism?
No, not at all. No, never.
In reporter speak, a fixer is a translator, navigator, and person finder for a journalist on unfamiliar ground. But in Iraq, where the streets are perilous, the fixer often is the unsung reporter who asks the questions and brings the answers back to his journalist boss. A great fixer can even save your life. One reporter described Ali Fadil as a rock star among fixers, smuggling one Western reporter under a blanket in a free fire zone, clearing the path for another who wanted to speak with some angry young man with guns. Now, Ali works as a freelancer, because working with Western reporters is more likely to get you killed. But even alone, it's still likely. George Packer.
They're targeted by the Sunni insurgents. If they write bad things about the Shiite militias, they're targeted by them. They often run afoul of the American military at checkpoints or simply by being in Baghdad and being Iraqi. And now more and more, the Iraqi government is their main enemy because it's clamping down on them, it's throwing them in jail, it's beating them up, it's keeping them from the news.
Last month, Ali Fadil wrote a piece in the New York Times praising the efforts of the Coalition Provisional Authority to establish a free press in Iraq.
Ali wrote that it would be very ironic if the Americans, having sort of fathered this democratic process and created an independent Iraqi press, watched while it turned into yet another state-controlled press corps like in every neighboring country. I would say, though, that unlike the Iraqi police and army, the young Iraqi journalists I know are real professionals and are quickly achieving sort of international standards of excellence and are winning awards and are keeping the world informed and are getting killed for it.
So I put it to Ali, currently studying journalism at New York University. This is a really dangerous job. You have a wife and two kids. How come you want to do it?
I want to correct this. I have an angry wife and two kids. She's very angry about my job. She hates that I'm doing this job. The reason why I like journalism, the reason why I thought that the risk you take while doing a story is worth it, is because I saw Western journalists throwing themselves in these remote areas of Iraq. I've never dreamed of going to these areas, and I think it's too dangerous just to be there as a human being, but they just go for the sake of the story. I worship this thing in journalism, and that's the way how it goes, and I think that's the way I'm going to take it. It's my country at the end, and I have access to many places in Iraq Westerners don't have.
Unlike Ali, Ayub Nouri did not become a journalist by accident. Born in the Kurdish town of Halabja, notoriously gassed by Saddam, he was a teenager when he met his first Western journalists, a British TV crew, who hired him as a translator. He was already an experienced reporter at the age of 24 when Elizabeth Rubin, filing for the New Republic just before the war, hired him as a fixer for a trip to an Arab part of Kurdistan.
And the Kurds were telling us, don't go, you're going to be killed. And Ayub basically said to me, though he is a Kurd, he said, don't trust these guys. They've been looting every single Arab village and they don't want us to see it. And so we went to this village and in fact there was a fight going on between the Kurds and the Arabs of this village because the Kurds were trying to steal all the petrol at this gas station. And in fact, that's exactly what they hadn't wanted us to see. And so we went and were with this Arab family, found out everything that was going on. And people trusted him because they saw that he was also not playing on any tribal card. You know, he was looking for the truth.
Everything goes back to not being free.
Ayub Nouri never believed he could be a journalist in Iraq because the media weren't free. But he always knew how it could sound because it poured out of his father's radio.
He was listening to the Persian and Arabic service of the BBC when I was a child, every morning, every night. And then I bought my own radio and listened to the BBC all day long. And I think that's how I learned my English, from listening to the BBC. I was jealous of the reporters when they were reading their sign off saying so-and-so from Kuala Lumpur, for example. That was my only dream, one day to be a reporter and say that.
For the world, I am Ayub Nouri, Baghdad.
We're talking to Ayub Nouri, who reports for the BBC. He's been telling me
for the world, this is Ayub Nouri, Kut, southern Iraq.
Ayub is also in New York at the moment, studying at Columbia Journalism School. But like Ziad, like Ali, Ayub is planning to head back. As the death toll mounts and the despair deepens in Iraq, these and many other Iraqi journalists are ready to stand up, even as Western journalists are forced to stand down. That piece was recorded 7 years ago. After finishing his studies here, Kurdish journalist Ayub Nouri returned to Iraq and traveled across the region for a wide variety of outlets. Now he's the managing editor for a news website called Rudaw.net.
Our main focus of coverage is the four parts of Kurdistan: Iraq, Iran, Turkey, and Syria.
And where are you based?
I am most of the time based in Toronto, Canada.
How come?
Because this is a faraway and quiet and peaceful place.
Do you feel like you've retired?
Yes, I feel like I've retired at the age of, I'm now 34, but I was 30 years old when I came here. Yes, I mean, 1 year in Iraq is equal to 5 years in another country. I love nature and I love big countries. I came here in the hope of slowly exploring this country and seeing the beautiful nature. Besides, it's a much more peaceful country than many places I've visited, including the U.S.
So you don't miss being in the heart of the action?
I actually do, but Iraq is still dangerous and you could lose your life at any moment. Today, this morning, before you called, I was listening to the radio and there have been a series of bombings in Baghdad. I realized I had done my share, my part of covering the war in Iraq. But I still miss being there and be in touch with people and write, because stories are still coming out. Every time you sit down with someone on a bus or in a tea shop, anywhere in Iraq, you would hear many stories that they haven't told anyone. I miss that part.
Ayub, thank you very much.
You are welcome. Thank you for calling me.
Ayub Nouri is the managing editor for Rudow.net, and he lives in Toronto. We found Zayad Qasim, the young Iraqi dentist who blogged for Healing Iraq, in San Antonio. When we spoke to him back in 2006, he was studying journalism at the City University of New York, and he was deeply conflicted.
I was very worried about my family because they were still all in Baghdad, and I was the only one who had left. And here I was reporting about noise pollution and stuff like that, and it didn't seem right to me. It was... I don't know. I was still consumed with worry all the time until my family safely left, and that was when I could finally breathe.
When I last spoke to you,
mm-hmm.
you were writing Healing Iraq, still wanting to be a dentist.
Well, I'm still working to be a dentist. I already took the qualifying exam, and I'm waiting for the state to take the second exam. In a couple of years, I should be ready to go. But it's not that I want to do dentistry, it's just that my family arrived here and they're having problems adjusting to life here. So I feel I have a responsibility to support them, and journalism just didn't do that for me.
You're still doing Healing Iraq?
Yeah, on and off. I try to keep it alive.
You know, I started my piece with the epigraph from yeah? Healing Iraq, that quote from Jonathan Swift, that says, it is useless to attempt to reason a man out of what he was never reasoned into. That's almost an argument against communicating at all.
I did a lot of posts about religion. I thought that the conflict had some side of it that was really connected to religion and sectarianism. It was just my general view of how people thought about it. They were just raised that way, and it was really hard for them to give it up. And that's what we're seeing right now in Iraq. People have forgotten the worst years of 2006 and 2007, and there's a return of sectarian killings and assassinations.
But do you believe that you can reason people out of it?
Well, we try that all the time. It's just, at some point, you really give up.
Zayad, thanks a lot.
No problem at all.
Zayad Qasim? Blogs still at Healing Iraq. When Ali Fadil, the doctor turned rock star fixer, finished his studies at NYU, he had the very American experience of not finding a job, partly because of the economic crash and partly because his usual clients had less interest in the war. So he applied for political asylum in the U.S. Anyway, he says journalism died in Iraq after the American forces left. The authorities bear down hard on reporters there.
It could be the security, the police, the army. Friends of mine who are still there quit journalism because it's becoming really dangerous. And not only dangerous, it's useless because you can't really move around and do what you want to do as we're used to before, when the streets were, you know, not controlled by anybody.
what you're saying is that you preferred, as a journalist, mm-hmm. the chaos in the street.
No, absolutely not. I'd rather have the country stabilized, but this is not stabilization. When you get the country back to point zero, you know, to square one after all the bloodshed, it's very important to keep democracy alive, if it was really meant to be.
And that's not what you see.
No, that's not what I see. Unfortunately, Iraq is not a country with democracy right now. The street is not really as peaceful as it looks. Basic life services are still not available. I remember a lot of these press conferences in the Green Zone, they were saying, oh, we'll come and see Iraq after 10 years, it'll be different. And you can see that things are not really different. There's lots of money there, that's true, but there's no life.
Any regrets?
Regrets about my ventures into the media? No, absolutely not. It's actually were one of the best years of my life. And I look forward to relive that experience, maybe not in Iraq, maybe somewhere else.
Have you become more skeptical of the power of journalism to change things?
I'm really convinced that journalism is a very powerful tool. It's a dangerous tool at the same time. That's why I'm frustrated that it's in the hands of the Iraqi government right now.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ali, how do you want to be identified?
As Ali Fadil, the journalist.
A journalist.
Uh-huh.
Ali Fadil, Iraqi journalist and medical resident, now living in Atlanta. That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Jamie York, Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sarah Abdurrahman, and Chris Neary. We had more help from Krista Ripple, Ravenna Koenig, and Alex Hall. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Rick Kwan. Katya Rogers is our senior producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news and our boss. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. Bob Garfield will be back next week. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
On the Media is supported by Reputation.com, working to protect individuals and businesses by ensuring accurate internet search results and authentic online reviews. More at Reputation.com or at 1-800-REPUTATION. Support for On the Media also comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. At GatesFoundation.org, the Joyce Foundation, working to improve the quality of life in the Great Lakes region. Learn more at JoyceFDN.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, presenting the MacArthur Award for Creative and Effective Institutions. Winners are at MacFound.org. This is NPR.
Thanks for listening to this week's On the Media podcast, a free service of WNYC Radio. Find out where On the Media is playing in your area and support your local public radio station by going to onthemedia.org. You can support this podcast by making a donation at wnyc.org.